Hello, welcome to The Deduction, a podcast from the Tax Foundation. This is your guide to the complex world of tax and economics. I'm Scott Hodge, president of the Tax Foundation, and I'll be your host for today's episode. Today, we're going to look at the world of excise taxes. What's an excise tax, you ask? Well, if you've ever purchased a gallon of gasoline, a pack of cigarettes, a bottle of wine, or even tires for a Mack truck, you have paid an excise tax. And who better to talk excise taxes with than the Tax Foundation's own expert, Ulrich Boesen. Ulrich, welcome.
Thank you, Scott.
Well, you've got a big study on excise taxes coming up. I've had a chance to see a draft. It looks like it's going to be a fantastic overview of the issue, soup to nuts. And probably, you know, we ought to start at the basic level. You know, what is an excise tax? What makes an excise tax different from, say, a sales tax, which is on products? Or are they basically the same?
So I think that's a very good place to start this discussion. An excise tax is by nature, by definition, selective. So when we levy excise taxes, we levy them on specific products, goods, or activities where there is an extraordinary reason to do so. So sales taxes or your common consumption taxes are levied on all consumption, whereas excise taxes, specific products, goods, or activities are selected for additional taxation. We normally levy them if there is a negative externality associated with the product. Mm-hmm. That could be something like harm from smoking. It could be cost of road maintenance that we levy on gasoline and diesel, or it could be another thing. So that's really where the difference is. It's the selectiveness of the tax that differs the sales tax from the excise taxes.
You know, one of the interesting things in your paper is a little short history of excise taxes. And I don't think even I realized that excise taxes or product specific taxes are really some of the oldest taxes ever levied. Well, what's the history there?
Excise taxes, one of the earliest records we have is an excise tax I found back in, I think it was 3,300 years before the year zero. And it was levied in ancient Egypt on cooking oil. And basically, the reason why these were popular back then is before, you know, we registered how much people were spending, or how much they were making, or maybe even how many people there were. But we could count products and goods. So you would be able to measure the amount of cooking oil someone had purchased or was using, and you would be able to tax that. So that's why excise tax has been popular through the times, is the ability to count and measure them makes them very good targets for taxation.
You know, it's kind of interesting. My wife and I were in Egypt a few years ago, and we were at the Great Pyramid, and we're out getting a little tour by one of the guides in one of the sites there. The guy pointed out a hieroglyphic or a painting of the tax collectors in Egypt, and they did not look like they were collecting the taxes in the most humane way. So it was a definitely taxation by force. It was kind of interesting. So when we think about sort of the activities, what's the breadth of things? You mentioned a few things, but what's the breadth of the kind of things that excise taxes are applied to?
Well, today, they're normally levied, as I said, on products where we perceive some kind of negative externality, or when we want to establish a user fee system. So I think the best examples are your so-called sin taxes. That'll be alcohol, that'll be gambling, that'll be tobacco. And then you have your more user fee-based systems where the excise tax you're levying really is a proxy for cost. The example here being motor fuel. We're saying the amount of motor fuel you purchase is a pretty good proxy for how much you're going to drive on the roads. So we're going to charge your user fee that way. Another example is that we pay an excise fee on firearms as a proxy for how much we use or for how much we hunt or utilize nature. And that money is then reinvested into making sure that the national parks and the like are well funded and available to everyone. So those are the main systems, how we use them.
Yeah, that's interesting. So there's really two ways. One is to dissuade people from doing things that we don't want them to do. And the other one is the user pay principle. And that is, it's really almost this user fee concept, which we would generally think is a good thing because it connects the tax with the activity that people are doing, such as driving and using the roads.
Absolutely. I think the sin tax system has kind of evolved from being, it used to be a revenue tool. Back in the day, 1934 is the first year of available data we have on the federal collections. And excise tax revenue made up 46% of the total tax revenue. That reliance and dependence has decreased significantly. So that in 2019, the excise tax revenue was only 2.9% of total tax collections. And I think the role of them have changed a little bit. Today, we use them to account for negative externalities. We use them to try and deter consumption of products that we don't like. But they used to be pure revenue tools. But our understanding of how to best use them has evolved.
That's really fascinating. The shift in the revenue base for the United States to go from being predominantly or significantly funded by excise taxes to have it almost be a trivial rounding error today. That's pretty remarkable, actually, when you think about it. And given the fact that we're still doing those things, whether it's driving on the roads or purchasing cigarettes or what have you, but I guess it's been all replaced by income taxes and other things.
Yeah.
Let's talk a bit about the design of excise taxes. You get into that in your paper, and I found that actually interesting. And I need you to educate me, too. I've been doing this a long time, and I still get confused about things like, what do you mean by ad valorem? I hear that a lot when I hear about excise taxes. These are done in an ad valorem way. Or you've got these other methods, I guess, that are more specific based on what, quantity, weight, volume, et cetera. Help me understand that, because I've always been confused by it.
So we normally have one of each system. So we'll either levy an excise tax based on the price. That's what we call ad valorem. Or we'll levy it based on quantity. That could be volume or weight or amount. That's what we call specific. So generally, the specific system is superior to the price-based system. That's because, as we talked about before, the excise tax's job is to account for a negative externality or to act as a user fee. Most often, almost always, that is associated with the amount you consume, right? The quantity you consume. It's the amount of cigarettes you smoke that determine the harm caused by it. It's the amount of gasoline you purchase that determines how much you use the roads. So it's almost always superior to levy the tax on the amount, because that's the best proxy for the negative externality. There's a few exceptions to this rule where the price may work as a good proxy, but generally, specific systems are superior to the price-based system.
So if the tax is on the price, that really disconnects it from whatever the end result or the goal or the mission of the tax and the purpose of it.
Absolutely. It almost looks like a sales tax at that point, just a very specific sales tax. And if that's the intention, then it's basically a revenue tool. You're no longer concerned with what the negative externality or harm is. You're just concerned with how much money is being created, how much economic activity there is, and you're trying to tax that. That's a revenue grab. That's nothing to do with trying to correct for negative externalities.
I think I saw in your paper, you've told me before, there are a bunch of states that levy the excise tax on top of the sales tax or vice versa. So you're almost double taxing the same product? That seems wrong.
Yeah, this is common. So oftentimes excise taxes will be levied earlier in the value chain. So it will be levied on the manufacturer or the wholesaler or the distributor. By the time it makes it to the shelf or the retailer, that's already built in. So when you levy the sales tax on the price paid at retail, you'll pay a tax on a tax.
Tell me a little bit more about that, because I didn't realize that excise taxes were essentially paid by the wholesaler or the distributor, because we tend to think of sales taxes or any kind of product-based taxes as paid like a sales tax by the consumer. But this is a different way of both taxing the product and collecting the revenue then.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, oftentimes it is paid by the consumer because the manufacturer will pass on that price. The distributor will pass on that tax to the consumer. But they won't see it. They won't know how much tax they've been paying. I think it's another good reason why specific taxes are better, because it allows the consumer to know how much he's paying in taxes. He knows how many cigarettes he's purchased. He knows how many gallons of gas he's purchased. But he wouldn't necessarily know the wholesale price or whatever the retailer paid for the gasoline or for the cigarettes. So if you have a price-based tax, he has no chance of knowing what he's paying in taxes. So a specific system is also more transparent for the taxpayer, because he'll be able to understand which part is the cost of the good and which part is tax.
I want to ask you a little bit about this issue of the sin taxes, or what they call what, Pigouvian taxes, right? Taxes that are intended to dissuade us from or discourage us from doing certain things, or at least to internalize the externalities that might come from the activity. It's kind of hard to figure out what that cost is, isn't it? I mean, you think of things like the carbon tax will be a big part of the future discussion, or even with tobacco taxes, figuring out what those costs are seems very difficult. And trying to then apply it to the product seems very challenging.
It's definitely one of the main challenges with designing excise taxes. So when you have to figure out the rate, you have to figure out what is the negative externality? What is the harm? What is the cost you're trying to internalize? And trying to determine exactly what that is almost impossible to do. You can't have a fully efficient tax. An example I think is good, which I also discuss in the paper, is the difference between externalities is also related to the amount that someone consumes. For instance, with alcohol, right? So harm is not necessarily linear. Mm-hmm. Each beer you drink may not carry the same externality. It might be the fifth beer or the sixth beer or the seventh beer that makes you get into your car, inebriated and get into issues. Or it might be the 10th glass of wine a week that causes some kind of health damage that'll end up creating issues. So figuring out exactly what the cost is impossible. But I think there's still a way to get to an estimate that makes sense. It's not unlike how insurance companies come up with premium costs. So you have to figure out this kind of behavior carries this kind of risk. There's likely to be this kind of cost. That's our estimate. There's also the revenue aspect of this. In order for this system to make sense, when you want to internalize an externality, you want to account for harm. This money needs to be returned into that system. And what I mean by that is, if you're using the motor fuel tax as a way to pay for roads, then the revenue from the motor fuel tax should be spent on roads. If you want to use the tobacco tax to internalize externalities associated with tobacco smoking, then the revenue from that tax should go back in to offset the cost associated with tobacco smoking. Mm-hmm. So there will be some costs there that a state government or local government determines. How much are we going to spend on this? And that's another workaround to figure out what the externality is, because the externality is what is being spent to offset the cost. And this can obviously be overdone. I think a number of states already have tax rates that are well beyond the cost associated with some of these behaviors. But generally, a pretty good estimate can be found. As long as the money is returned into the system, I think there's a legitimate tax that consumers, in most cases, will be, if not happy to pay, then at least understand why they have to pay.
So if the state is providing cessation services or some sort of a health-related program, then you're saying that would then be costed out as the externality that Sure. would then be paid for by the tax. But then anything above that is just simply a revenue take.
Exactly.
I understand that right?
Yeah. Yep, exactly.
Huh. Yeah, that's interesting. Stories are legendary about various types of excise taxes and the effects that it has on behavior. I mean, you do have, obviously, the goal is to, I don't know, tax something so people consume less of it, whether it's tobacco or soda or alcohol or drive less, for that matter. So you've got the behavioral effects, but then there are other effects that are not so good. Whether it's, smuggling that we hear of, black markets, bootlegging. I mean, I guess, these kind of excise taxes can almost lead to almost a prohibition-like outcome that is certainly an unintended consequence of the tax. And talk about some of those, because those can be, far more severe than the tax itself.
Yeah, I think a good way to think about it is that everything has externalities. Everything we do have externalities, and we shouldn't try and account for all of it in the tax code, right? That would be impossible. But that means taxes themselves carry externalities. And I think those were some of the ones that you mentioned right there. If you overindulge and raise a tax to be too high, you're likely to cause some unintended consequences. We see that in states like New York, Minnesota, California, and Washington that have really high taxes on cigarettes. Mm-hmm. In all those states, over 40% of cigarettes consumed are not taxed by that state. That means they're flowing in from neighboring states, from illicit sources. So you can definitely overdo it and create other and sometimes even worse externalities by trying to account for them. It's very important that...
Criminal behavior, essentially, right?
Exactly. I mean, that's what it is. It is criminal behavior. And we see them in a number of these categories. The thing is, elasticities are often low when we're talking about excise products, because some of them have addictive qualities. Mm. That means when you keep raising price, that doesn't necessarily mean the consumer is going to quit or stop consuming it. He's going to continue to try and fulfill his craving. And at some point, he may even look for illegal sources to fulfill that. We see it with gambling, you see it with alcohol, and you see it with tobacco. And we've seen it with cannabis that has been illegal for so long. It's not stopped anyone who wanted it from getting it.
Let's talk about some of the other effects that what economists call substitution effects. And I was thinking, saw in your paper that people, if you tax soda too much, they just shift to things like beer because the price almost becomes equivalent, or you've just basically chased someone into another activity. And talk a little bit about that, because that has gotten clearly an unintended consequence of the tax.
Yeah, it's an interesting result of a study that was done after a couple of localities introduced beverage taxes. And they were looking at substitutes. What do people do when beverages are more expensive? And one of the findings were they are buying more beer. And I think it's important to remember these taxes, which are often dubbed soda taxes, are actually beverage taxes. It's a lot of beverages that are covered. It's everything from soda all the way out to stuff like kombucha, which are otherwise considered healthy. It just has to have added sugar in them. The issue with excise taxes, and one of the reasons we shouldn't rely on them to generate general fund revenue, is that the base is exceedingly narrow. It's often just one product, one ingredient, one activity that is taxed. That makes it very easy for consumers to substitute to other goods that may satisfy a craving, whether that's sugar that you can also get from candy or from chocolate bars, whether that's gambling that you may get from an illicit provider or other. Because the base is so narrow, it is super easy to find substitute goods. And it also dictates how lawmakers should think about their tax base. We said in the beginning, you should tax this based on quantity, but that's not the only question you need to answer when you're figuring out what the tax base is. You also need to think about what kind of products exactly are in the tax base. Hmm. For sugar-sweetened beverage or the beverage tax, oftentimes you'll have some exclusions. You won't tax 100% fruit juice. You won't tax unflavored milk products and the like. But some localities still tax diet beverages, for instance. And then it just looks like a revenue grab.
Right.
For other products, such as tobacco products, there's a big discussion going on right now whether non-tobacco containing nicotine products should be taxed like tobacco products, because the nicotine itself is derived from tobacco. And vapor products and cigarettes are clearly substitute goods. We've seen that for the last 15 years. Mm-hmm. Most vapers are former smokers. That's where they go. And some states are including vapor products into that tobacco category. Now, before I discuss undesired substitution, right, you don't want people to switching from a Diet Coke to a beer, but you do want smokers to switch from cigarettes to vapor products because they're less harmful.
Sure.
They're better for you.
Right.
And that's another of the issues we see with the substitutions, right? There can be desired substitutions that you might make more difficult for consumers if you make your tax base too broad and include too many products. Don't share those same negative externalities as the originally taxed product.
So now you've essentially discouraged people from going to things that are less harmful in the process of trying to tax the product, and completely self-defeating. Let's talk about another impact of excise taxes that certainly I think more people are aware of, and that is the regressive aspect of it, and how excise taxes tend to impact low-income people more than high-income people.
Yeah, so I think a good starting point here is generally consumption taxes are regressive, and that's just by nature, because people who make less spend more of their income on consumption. So if we're just looking at how much did you spend on consumption as a percentage of your income, consumption taxes look regressive. Excise taxes often have additional characteristics that might make them even more regressive. That's because consumption doesn't always increase when income increases. An example from the federal tax code is, if we look at the effective tax rates across income groups, the lowest quintile pays a rate 9 times higher than the top 1%. There can be good reasons for that. I don't think regressivity is an argument necessarily against excise taxes as a concept, but it should underline this argument that you don't want to rely on these taxes for your general fund. You don't want to be asking those who can least afford it to pay most for our general services.
What does that say about, we've seen in various states where they've tried to, say, lower personal income taxes and increase excise or sales taxes. Essentially, that would seem to shift the burden away from high-income people to low-income people.
I think that's true. If your switch is from income taxes to excise taxes, I think that's true. I think asking wage earners to pay less and then asking people or the general population to pay more in excise taxes, which falls so heavily on the lowest quintile, is not good tax reform. I will say the sales tax is a little bit different because general consumption normally increases with ability to pay. So you do have people who make more spend a lot more in general consumption and thus pay a lot more in sales taxes. So that one's much less regressive than specific excise taxes, especially the ones that fall on categories of products that are more often consumed by low-income Americans, like tobacco or sugar-sweetened beverages.
So a broad-based sales tax, which I think we generally understand is less economically harmful than, say, income taxes, that switch is probably a good thing economically. Absolutely. But okay, I hear what you're saying. So the switch from income taxes to specific things like tobacco taxes and the like would be definitely an economically poor trade.
Yeah, I think so. I think it may work out in the short term in terms of those excise taxes may raise enough revenue to cover the offset. Mm-hmm. But these categories tend to be a lot more unstable in the long run. There's been less and less smoking year on year for the last few decades, which means that category is raising less and less revenue every year. So that's not a very stable revenue source to want to rely on for general services. I mean, if that revenue source is going to pay for schools in 10 years and there's going to be whatever, 20% fewer smokers, then you're not going to want to rely on that. You want a much more stable revenue source. And that's where the general sales tax comes in. And that's why you want to have that as broad as possible to cover as many goods as possible so that it is as stable as it can be over time.
It almost seems to be competing or contradictory goals of the tax, where, you know, lawmakers will say, yeah, we want to tax this product because we want less of the thing or the behavior. We want less smoking, or we want less drinking, or less soda being consumed. Oh, but we want all the revenues. Well, this if one succeeds, then you're not going to get the other. And we've probably seen that in various places. I guess Philadelphia is one of the better examples of a failed soda tax, which was intended to fund educational services or schools. And then because the tax basically chased purchases out of the city, then revenues collapsed and there wasn't enough money for the education goals that they had in mind. So they are kind of self-defeating policies in many respects.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. I think you can obviously, to some extent, reduce consumption a little bit and raise a little bit of revenue at the same time. But oftentimes you hear lawmakers wanting to maximize for both at the same time, saying we want half the smokers but double the revenue. And those two things obviously don't go hand in hand. It's going to be either or. And I think at the same time, it also illustrates an issue that you might have other policies that will affect your tax base because there is this desire to deter consumption of a certain good. And I think what we've seen with tobacco products lately is a prime example. So states do rely on revenue from tobacco, right? They get excise taxes, their sales taxes, they get master settlement money. It's a quite big amount of money that each state gets from the tobacco companies and from tobacco users. And then at the same time, you have a bunch of people out in the states that want to limit that consumption. So they come up with things like tobacco flavor bans. And I'm going to use Massachusetts as an example because they're the only ones who have a statewide ban. They passed a ban that took effect last June where they banned all flavored tobacco, including menthol cigarettes. And what we saw in the following 6 months was a decline in sold cigarettes of 24%. That translates to over $60 million for the state of Massachusetts that they lost in revenue. Now, I think some people would call that a success if that consumption had just disappeared. But of course, it didn't disappear. People just drove to New Hampshire and Rhode Island instead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think
New Hampshire had increases of 35% of sales in the same period of time. So all they achieved in Massachusetts was to send a bunch of their tax revenue to their neighbors while they still have to carry all the costs of smoking and negative externalities associated with that, but with much less revenue. And that's one of the dangers of narrow taxation, especially on products where other unrelated regulatory policies might come in and affect your tax revenue so dramatically.
I'm going to editorialize a little bit. I happened to be in Massachusetts when I think that ban came out. And at the same time, the governor announced he wanted to expand the number of cannabis dispensaries in the state. So it's like, what? you're going to limit flavored tobacco and at the same time expand consumption of cannabis. So I that just seemed a little contradictory to me. But my wife's brother-in-law disagreed with me. He didn't understand the contradiction. But anyway, hey, I did want to ask, you're a native of Denmark, and Europe has had a lot of experience with this. And Denmark is famous for having the fat tax, which was trying to tax various goods that had fat in it, including butter and cheese and things like that. And obviously, many of the Nordic countries have some of the highest excise taxes or product-related taxes. What's the experience of that? Have you seen in terms of cross-border sales and that sort of thing?
In most Scandinavia, cross-border sales is sort of a sport that everyone participates in. It's very specific from country to country, which products are most tempting to go to another country to buy. Yeah. For Denmark, Danes will drive to Germany for alcohol, and they generally do it every time there's a party of a certain size. If they're going to a summer house for a couple of weeks, they need to stock up. They'll just make the trek down there, purchase it down there, and then bring it up. In Norway, where tobacco taxes are really high, they purchase all their tobacco in Sweden. Mm. And that's just the way it works. I think the fat tax that you brought up, I think, is a great example of trying to internalize too many things, right? It's like, okay, this product may have some externalities. Let's fix it through the tax code. And they ran into exactly some of the issues we've discussed today. Mm-hmm. It turned out to be very regressive. It turned out to be very expensive for companies to comply with. They had to spend a lot of money to figure out exactly how much trans fat is in this product and what's my tax liability. And it was very expensive to enforce and collect for the tax collectors. So by the end of the day, they got rid of it after just a few years because it was not worth it to have that tax because it didn't really do anything for anyone except put a lot of cost on business and a lot of cost on people who could least afford it.
What would you leave people with? What's kind of the takeaway from this marvelous paper that you have written and I encourage all the listeners to come to our website and taxfoundation.org and look up Ulrich's paper. It'll be released here in the next couple of days. What's the takeaway that you would give legislators, lawmakers, and politicians about excise taxes? And I guess what's the takeaway for average people?
The main takeaway that anyone who designs or writes excise tax should take away is that excise taxes should be imposed with caution. As I said, they're not very stable revenue generators. Their base is super narrow. They tend to be highly regressive. So you don't want to levy them to generate funds for important spending programs that are probably going to be recurring. You just can't trust that revenue to come in every year. And you don't want to move the burden to those among us who can least afford it. So that would be my main takeaway for lawmakers, and really be cautious when you levy excise taxes. I think for the general person, it's always good to know your tax code and know what you're paying in taxes. And excise taxes are almost always built into the price, so we rarely know what we're paying. Mm. But having a little bit of an understanding of how these are levied or how they should be levied will help you understand what you may be paying today that you maybe don't know about. And I think that's always important. I think something we always advocate, that taxpayers should be better informed about what kind of taxes they're paying and what the revenue is being spent on. And excise taxes is very often a black box where it's hard to know where that revenue is going. It's very hard to know what you're paying as a taxpayer. So this will allow you to lift the lid a little bit, figure out how they're levied today, what you're likely to be paying, and maybe how it could be improved.
Well, thank you, Ulrich. That's just tremendous. And I encourage everybody to look up your paper on our website. Thank you all for tuning into The Deduction today. It's been a fascinating discussion about excise taxes. And I look forward to talking to you on the next episode of The Deduction in your podcast queue soon. I'm Scott Hodge, President of the Tax Foundation. Thank you for joining us and be safe.
And that wraps up this episode of The Deduction. We'd love to hear what you think about this podcast. Please let us know at taxfoundation.org/podcast.